Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
It's just the kind of the way we see the world. So if that was the prism, then so be it. We didn't think to say, let's get out there and change the world.
Keegan-Michael Key and his comedy partner Jordan Peele tackle everything from race relations to gay marriage to women's rights on their Emmy-nominated Comedy Central show Key and Peele. They've broken new social ground in the sketch comedy world, but their main goal? Just to be funny. The series ends its 5-season run in September, and Key tells us why they opted to quit their show at the height of its popularity. But first, on the news banter, Universal has a stellar summer at the box office thanks to Straight Outta Compton. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my podcast co-host, Joe Adalian, the West Coast editor of Vulture.com, and he hosts with me the spinoff on KCRW.com. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Michael.
So Straight Outta Compton, some folks were surprised that this turned into a mega hit. I wasn't. I kind of thought that the marketing was pretty savvy. There are a lot of folks who grew up with NWA, the group that's depicted in the movie, that kind of want to see the origin story of this landmark band. And they seem to do everything right, and it has paid off at the box office.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the movie hit a sweet spot in that it appeals to both millennials and Gen Xers. And, you know, tied to the fact that you also had Dr. Dre finally, 15 years later, come out with a new album just before the movie was released was also part of that. It was sort of a big event.
Yeah, and as a result, opening weekend, it did $60.2 million domestically and was on track as we're recording this to have a second fantastic weekend as well. And it's really fueling the great year that Universal is having. It's best on record, and it's hit the $5 billion mark in global box office quicker than any other studio in history. Pretty amazing for a studio that just a few years ago was really on the ropes. There was a regime change, as there always are in cases like this, where Adam Fogelson was ousted in 2013. Donna Langley came in. She shepherded a lot of the projects that Adam had brought to the studio, like Jurassic World and Pitch Perfect 2. She brought in new titles like Minions, and it's all paid off.
It has. And, you know, of course, movie studios historically have really good years and bad years. This is definitely going to be a record year, and they've did a lot of things right. Even more than the TV business, you know, you and I cover TV most of the time. And with television, you know, networks, there's tend to be some stability. Every once in a while, networks have a bad year, but it usually takes a few years. For movie studios, the change can happen very quickly if the movies don't come together. In this case, everything has come together quite brilliantly. And I think it's what I like about the Universal slate, it really living up to the title of the studio, it does seem very diverse. You know, with Disney these days, it's really just big franchises and little else. But Universal seems to have a really good mix of sort of those big tentpole franchises as well as some original things such as Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, and you mentioned that these studios, they have up years and down years. If anyone's having a troubled summer this year, it's Warner Brothers, which has struggled with several of its big releases, including most recently Guy Ritchie's The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But none of their movies have even reached $500 million worldwide this summer. A couple have come close, including San Andreas, the Dwayne Johnson thriller from earlier this summer. But it's a rough time for Warner Brothers.
I don't understand why you greenlight The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in 2015. You know, I don't think baby boomers really want to see that. It was never a huge hit. It doesn't have a lot of brand awareness, and we're not lacking for spy stories out there. So why do that?
And meanwhile, Warner Brothers executives have to be kicking themselves because one of the big titles that they did pass on was Straight Outta Compton. Speaking of a tumultuous summer, media stocks continue to be battered. It all started a few weeks ago when Bob Iger went out there and said, we are seeing some softness in terms of subscriptions for ESPN, and that threw all of Wall Street into a tizzy, even though, again, as we've mentioned previously on this show, this is a topic that's been discussed for years now, the fact that things are changing the way people consume television and purchase television. But nonetheless, we saw what some are calling the August reset again. Stocks are down, including Disney, as well as 21st Century Fox and Comcast as of tape time. Joe, is this basically a summer of adjustment for Wall Street as they finally figure out that things are changing in the media business?
I think it's a little bit of an overreaction on Wall Street's part. You know, I think that nothing has fundamentally changed in the last year or two, except that Netflix is doing a lot more shows. And yes, there are some ratings declines. And yes, advertising is absolutely going down. But, you know, it's not as if these big media companies haven't been saying this for years and haven't been doing everything they can to adjust. They're not just going to wake up and suddenly say, where did our viewers go? They knew that this was coming, and they've been working very hard to get the revenue stream. So, you know, you have Disney and CBS and other companies working to open up supply lines to SVOD, and they're getting paid by Netflix and Amazon and Hulu for their content. They're getting paid for with international. They're making sure to own their own content. So yes, one way of making money off of television, that is selling advertising, is certainly challenged. And yes, cable subscriptions are going to go down. But let's face it, even in this coming era of what's called the skinny bundles, right, where people might have more choice and they can choose what channels they want, the big guys are still going to do fine. Everyone's going to make sure they still subscribe to the big networks and ESPN. It's the smaller channels that really should be in trouble.
Right. Well, and even cord cutting is sort of a misnomer of a term anyway, because yes, people are moving toward SVOD, but they're using set-top boxes, which, by the way, still have cords. So people are still using boxes with cords that are connected to their television sets. It's just the cord goes to a different provider than before.
You know, what's really needs to happen is the measurement of these audience needs to step up. These big companies need to be able to show their shareholders that people are still watching our product, don't worry, and make sure that they're getting paid for
it. And that's been a big problem this summer, where although there's been a lot of great new buzzy programs on cable, including USA's Mr. Robot and the show Unreal on Lifetime, it's been a pretty soft summer for both broadcast and cable.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, I hate to use this cliched phrase, but it really is the new normal. Ratings are basically down across the board this year. And we're going to see this, I think, again, when the fall shows premiere next month and in October, we're going to see some really scary numbers. You know, don't be fooled when a big show like Empire comes along and does massive numbers, or How to Get Away with Murder. Definitely, there are going to be big shows that still exist. But because we live in an era of so much content and so many ways of watching that content, there are just going to be more shows that debut to soft numbers. But they're going to be shows that survive for many years. The Americans is going into its fourth season on FX with what have historically been pretty soft numbers, but it's still working.
And I'm going to predict right now, Universal will come out with Straight Outta Compton, the TV series. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Mike.
That's Joe Adalian, the West Coast editor of Vulture.com and co-host of KCRW's TV podcast, The Spinoff. In their sketch comedy show Key and Peele, Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele play a vast array of characters of different ages, races, even genders. They've played doomed couple Megan and Andre.
Uh-uh, it doesn't work like that. No one checks me because I'm not luggage, okay? So you can go yourself.
Megan, seriously?
No!
Pirates with surprisingly progressive politics.
We say oh-ho, but we don't say ho.
And dozens of college football players.
X Wayne at Aliciousness, Missouri Western State University.
Sequester Grundle Plith, MD, Adam State.
Scoise Velociraptor Malois, South Dakota State University.
The player formerly known as Mouse Cop.
One of the most famous characters for Keegan-Michael Key, our guest today, is Luther, President Obama's anger translator. Jordan Peele plays the president.
My intentions as your president are coming from the right place.
They're coming from Hawaii, which is where I'm from, which is in the United States of America, y'all. Okay? This is ridiculous. I have a birth certificate. I have a birth certificate. I have a hot, diggity, doggity, mama say, mama samu, makusa birth certificate, you dumbass crackers.
Okay. So, Luther, rope it in.
Both Peele and Key spent years in the world of improv and appeared on Fox's Mad TV before their manager suggested they team up to do Key and Peele. The show has been a hit for Comedy Central. Online, their YouTube views are in the hundreds of millions. Their viral-ready sketches are both absurd and smart, often taking on key cultural issues, from homophobia to racism and police brutality. Key and Peele won a Peabody and received 8 Emmy nominations this year, including Best Variety Sketch Series and a Supporting Actor nod for Keegan-Michael Key. It's a bittersweet time to be a Key and Peele fan. Just as the show is starting to gather the critical acclaim fans have long thought it deserved, Key and Peele made an announcement recently that the current 5th season would be the show's last.
Our timing is impeccable. Yeah. Isn't it? Maybe that's not the word that Comedy Central would use, but
yeah.
We've decided to go the British route. which is that, you know, it's not a narrative. So we haven't reached this peak where it's come to a natural end, where, you know, in a lot of English and British programming, you go, and that's the end of the series. We always meant it to be this long. This was an 87-hour long film, and now it's finished. Of course, people go, but you could keep going. You could keep going. It takes quite a lot of time to film, to do the seasons the way that we've wanted to do them, and to achieve what we wanted to achieve, quite frankly, cinematically. So it takes about 10 and a half months to do a season. And as popularity was growing, we were getting opportunities to do other things that were really appealing to us. But on top of it, there's this sense of, I fear us repeating ourselves. Because I think that we have a very, very intelligent audience. And I wouldn't want our audience to look at the material and go, wait a minute, they've pretty much done this scene before, but now it's in an old Western town. I guess we'd rather kind of be a comet that zeniths and burns out brightly than become established and people feel some kind of strange obligation to watch the program.
Well, was there ever a thought of doing sort of a Louis C.K., Larry David style hiatus? Just, you know what, we're going to take some time off. We'll revisit this. We're not going to tell you when or where, but one day, Comedy Central, you will get a phone call and we'll be ready.
I think that that is actually, to be quite honest, that's the plan. That is the plan. I would really like it to be a bit of a prior Wilder dynamic, so that the two of us will go and do our things and then come back in, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4 years and make another film together. And when the time is right and the idea is right, that excites us. And then just keep doing that and undulating through time that way. You know, every 3 or 4 years, come back together. Hey, old friend. And do a project together. And we've discussed with Comedy Central some of those projects being a reunion special that, you know, might involve a tour. All these ideas have been bandied about, certainly in the last year and a half. So I think that there is a very, very strong possibility of all that taking place.
So Comedy Central did know this was coming, so they kind of had time to prepare. I assume they still sort of, you know, begged, maybe pleaded a little bit, perhaps drove over a Brinks truck, any of the above. Was it hard to break the news to them? Because they're losing everyone right now.
It really is the worst time. They're putting fingers in dikes and they're trying to stop all the leaks and that's what it certainly appears like. But they're
dodging Amy Schumer right now, right?
It's yes, like,
Amy
Schumer's online too. We're not here. If Amy calls, we're not here. Right? Exactly. And but I'm so confident by the people that are running the ship over there. And so I think they're going to be just fine. It feels weird now, like people are abandoning ship, but I think it's a testament to them, to the talent they've hired.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the end of Key and Peele because, you know, your show, you know, it's kind of important. And I don't know how you feel about, you know, when people talk about, you know, sort of the legacy of Key and Peele and how it also is part of the conversation and the social conversation right now in America and how important the show has been in terms of some of the issues that you guys have tackled, you know, from race relations and other cultural commentary as well. And what kind of void that leaves on television. Is that a concern for you? And have you heard from other people who also feel like you guys are kind of leaving a little bit of a void here?
I have heard that. And I think there's some of that was mentioned in this New York Times article that came out. And I guess I feel a twinge of guilt about stopping. The interesting thing is it was not necessarily me and Jordan's intention to do that, to be this thing that was going to be huge and zeitgeisty. It was always about saying, oh, this is probably the best way to implement this joke. So we were thinking at it from a craft point of view, from a mechanics point of view. And it's just the kind of the way we see the world. So if that was the prism, then so be it. We didn't think to say, let's get out there and change the world. I mean, as much as I enjoyed I enjoy the work of, you know, Godfrey Cambridge and Dick Gregory. That was a different time. And I think what we were trying to do is tell the funniest human stories we could. Now, there were times from a comedic point of view where we were saying, oh my gosh, this piece feels special. This feels like, and we would say things like, this feels like it could be a Monty Python piece that might live forever, maybe. For us to be so presumptuous, right? But we weren't trying necessarily to get out there and save the world. But does it leave a void? I think so. But also, Michael, my hope would be, I hope that we can inspire others to move forward and move in this direction, and people feel like they're making also comedy of substance. Because there were times, very often times, when we were trying to make comedy of substance. I'd say the majority of the time, the lion's share, let's just make sure it's funny. And so my hope would be maybe people will look at it as a call to action to do the same and use it as a tool.
Do you feel like we're seeing more diversity in comedy now? As you know, we've seen Saturday Night Live try to make an effort to get more diverse, and I know I've heard you before discuss. The hope is that maybe, especially in the world of improv and sketch, that more people of color might be interested in getting into that that work.
I'm definitely seeing that in the online space, and to go back to our most recent employers. You know, I've seen some stuff on the digital side from ComedyCentral.com, and I see more and more people. I think as we're in this new wild, wild west where I can go online and see a Hispanic sketch group, or I can see an Indian sketch group. It's burgeoning, and hopefully other people will say, "Oh, I see something behind that." But the hard part is, it's when you're looking at little show and big business. That's where the majority of the people in our country, they're still watching television in that paradigm. So if they think it's going to make money, they'll give you a shot. If they think it's too obscure, even if the quality's there, if people in power think it's too obscure and they can't make money, they're not going to do anything with it. So I think the only thing you can do is thank God we have YouTube. Thank God we have metrics, because they can't deny a metric. If they're looking at hits, they go, oh, well, this sketch group here has 20 million hits for all of these videos, we should check them out, which is not a thing that we had in the 80s or 90s or even the turn of the century. So I think it's becoming more equitable because of new media platforms, and I hope it just continues that way. And then you find the next In Living Color or the next Chappelle or the next Key and Peele. I mean, there are people out there who want to give them a chance. I really believe that.
Well, I wonder I'm sure you think about this a lot in terms of sort of what has made the show so successful, but it does seem like the formula that you guys have, where the sketches start in a normal, familiar place that everyone sort of sees and they sort of recognize before things go in either weird or absurd or heightened places, is sort of a formula that's really worked for you guys.
Yeah, yeah. And if you go back, if you watch sketches from the first season, a lot of that was forming in the first season. And there's a term that Jordan coined for it. He calls it comedic judo. So we figured, let's take all the forms that everybody knows or thinks they know about sketch. Let's always start there and then find a way to use their expectations against them. So the perfect example would be in our first season or early second season, we had a sketch called Movie Hecklers. So all you know is you're like, uh-oh, there's two black guys that look thugs sitting in a movie theater. Man, I know this sketch. I get this already. They're going to talk while everybody else is watching the movie. And then the white people are going to go, shh, please stop talking, which by the way, is like, I don't know any white people that talk that way. When you see like Def Comedy Jam comics, like, and all the white people just, I'm like, I just don't know any white people that talk that way. Anyway, and then of course these two guys clearly went to like AFI. they're just like, man, look, the mise en scène doesn't make any sense as we're moving through the narrative, man. It's a spotty narrative at best. Now, why would you use a crane shot there? And then the white guy sitting in front of him is like, they're making some pretty good points, honey. So you screw up the audience's mind. You give them, just on a silver platter, what the expectation of the sketch should be, and then you flip it on them.
Coming up after a short break, Keegan-Michael Key tells us why he doesn't read online comments and how he reacts to viewers who just don't get the joke. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider, filling in for Kim Masters. We're talking to Keegan-Michael Key, one half of the hit sketch comedy duo Key and Peele. Their show will come to an end when their fifth season on Comedy Central wraps on September 9th. Which is much too soon for some fans. Fortunately, both Peele and Key will continue to work in the comedy realm. They've already taken on several film projects, and many of their Key and Peele sketches will continue to live online, like their bit where Key plays a substitute teacher from the inner city filling in at a mostly white suburban school.
Where is A.A. Ron right now? No A.A. Ron, huh? Well, you better be sick, dead, or mute, A.A. Ron.
Here.
Oh, man.
Why didn't you answer me the first time I said it, huh?
Huh?
I'm just asking, I said it like four times, so why didn't you say it the first time I said A.A. Ron?
Because it's pronounced Aaron?
Son of a bitch! You done messed up, A.A. Ron!
That particular sketch has more than 82 million views. Key says that he and Peele were well aware that much of their audience would only ever encounter their work in bits and pieces online, but they never forgot that they were crafting a TV show.
We still made an effort to say, you know, this scene, which is the most energetic scene, is going to be the crest of the episode, and then we'll have another scene that's maybe a two-person one that's a little intimate here, and then we'll either go out with a bang or out with some crazy absurdity at the end of the sketch. So we were always forming episodes, and that's part of our Second City training, because when you go see a review at Second City, it has movements in it and undulation and dynamics. We wanted our 21 minutes or our 30 minutes, including the commercials, because they dictate also how the flow of the show works, to work in a particular way. You know, I guess I wish more people were watching the entire piece every week on television to see the movements. And here's the adagio, and here's the andante, and here's a retard here. And ooh, look at that glissando. Like, so that it feels like a piece of music, a piece of chamber music. But, you know, it is what it is. You've got to give them what they want. And what's so interesting is the demographic, you know, Michael, they're young people, and that's how they consume entertainment these days. And so you can't argue with the fact that it is part of the success of the show.
Yeah, I think the stat that in that New York Times story, they mentioned your show averages about 1.2 million people on Comedy Central in its first run, mm-hmm. but the videos have been streamed more than 72 million times in the first 4 weeks of the current season. So that's a lot of streams.
Yeah. And we're quickly approaching. I think we're very quickly approaching in the aggregate, historically in the aggregate, we're well approaching a billion hits overall. And I mean, clearly there's something in the zeitgeist. There's a way that the world is working now, and there's nothing we could do to change what that was. It's been very informative and exciting to watch this new thing happen. And how are we going to deal with it in the future? It's funny. They came and talked to us about ratings this year. We got emails this year about, okay, guys, so here's how the ratings are going to work this year. We're not going to give you any same-day ratings anymore. We're just going to give you live plus 3 and live plus 7.
Yeah, and even that feels like that's not enough considering how people are watching later on,
right,
and online and everything else. And what's interesting is you guys even created a web series called Critiquer's Corner, where you kind of had some fun with the whole nature of online critiques and this culture now, of course, of people going online and anonymously just kind of trashing things. Do you ever pay attention to what people say online? Do you read the comments?
I can't read the comments. I'm too fragile. I'm too fragile of a person because I'll look at my wife and go, now why would they say something that cruel? And so I'll refrain from telling you the comments. But you know, there are people who make these vlogs, and that's why Jordan and I created these characters, Vandavion and Mike, to do a vlog where there's ostensibly what's happening is they're trying to get a writing job on Key and Peele.
Mm-hmm.
That's the subtext. What's happening on top is they're saying, you know, Key and Peele, We like to say that Key and Peele is indeed a funny show and whatnot, but what we're trying to do, like what we're trying to do for real, like from our point of view, is like tell them they need to put more poop and like more like genitalia stuff in their show because they missing laughs. So the character profile of these two guys is that all of their humor is puerile and sophomoric because they're in this kind of state of arrested development.
Uh-huh.
And we thought there's probably a preponderance of people like this who watch our show. Like, we want to portray people who we think don't get our show or don't get the comedic engine behind the sketches.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a phenomenon that's taking place in our world right now. And that was one of our ways of being topical, you know.
Well, I also wonder, one of the other stats that was kind of interesting from that New York Times article is they mentioned that by one Nielsen metric, your show's viewership is 74% white. And I'm kind of curious, I imagine you probably hear from some people who kind of just miss the point of what you're actually doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are sometimes, I think, to be quite honest, there are times when I have come across people who will be talking to me about the substitute teacher sketch. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think you're racist.
What do they say?
It'll just be
that's what they do, man.
Oh no.
But that's what they do. They do, man. That's true. That's just true, man. Those are the names they give their kids.
Those are the names they give their kids. I'm them. And if I had a kid, I would give my kid a name that I would enjoy. There's not a single story in the Black experience. So you have to look at us as a mosaic. You can't just look at us as a single thing. So it's like they. When I hear the word they, my neck bristles a little bit. So then I kind of go, I get that they're enjoying it. I think they're getting the joke, but they're not getting the underpinnings of the joke. And I think the 74% white is a lot of the demographic of Comedy Central. This is why Jordan and I are passionate about finding a way to have people of color enter the realm of sketch and enter the realm of improv. Another wonderful observation my partner made was African-Americans, young African-Americans, they do improvise. But what they do is they don't know they have this avenue available to them. So they go into hip hop. They go into freestyling. They go into jazz. That's what they do because they don't know that improv even exists. And so, you know what I mean? There's a demographic that improv is not reaching. And if it was, we'd be getting even newer, fresher, more unique, more dangerous, more fantastically hysterical stories that aren't part of the social fabric yet. But they're not aware of it. And it's nobody, I mean, I don't think it's anybody's, if it's anybody's fault, it's our fault now. We're the ones that need to take up the mantle.
And now that you guys have become pretty much household names, you're kind of helping lead this movement. This has been such an interesting year for you. We can't not mention earlier this year when your character Luther showed up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Of course, you know, you're Obama's anger translator, actually with President Obama himself. So will we see Luther again with the president before the end of his term? Probably
not before the end of his term, but I'm going to have to give the president a call and say, sir, I'm just wondering, when you get on that lecture circuit, like, what are we doing? What are we thinking about here?
Right.
I'd take 3 years off and do some little I don't think we'll see him before the end of the year, but it's just one of the most sublime experiences of my life. And Jordan, once again, I just keep quoting my partner because he just has these wonderful, succinct, salient points that he makes. He believes this, and I believe this. I don't know that we would have had a show. I don't know if there would be a Key and Peele if he had not been elected the president. If people were not aware that this is an experience that is happening in America. Here's a person who's raised by a white mother, a single parent, and that's part of our fabric as well as any other immigrant story or rags to riches story, or pull yourself up by the bootstrap story. His story became international news. And then Jordan and I were allowed to ride those coattails in a way and say, hey, guess what? That's my story. I feel very akin to the president, for real, because we literally share a story. And so does Jordan. And so I think we really, really owe him a great debt of gratitude.
Promise me if there is a President Trump, you'll come back and do something about that.
Oh, we're going to have to. I mean, we're going to have to. We'd be being really irresponsible if we don't do that.
Well, Keegan-Michael Key, thank you so much for joining us on The Business.
Thank you, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and JC Swadek. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider. Kim Masters will be back next week on The Business. See you then.